I'm Algernon Cash, and you're locked in. If you have been a member of my audience for any period of time, you know how much I enjoy meeting new people and striking up conversations. And just here in the last couple of weeks, I was at one of my favorite coffee spots. I'm not going to tell you where it is because I don't want all of you to show up there. This is where I like to have my period of silence. But I did have an opportunity to meet a new friend. And it turned out that Miss Virginia Sumney, she is a professor, a historian, a writer, just someone that is full of so much great insight and great information. I've had a chance to share a cup of coffee with her and conversation. And I was so impressed with the conversation that I just had to bring it here to my audience. And the timing was great, Virginia, because it's Women's History Month. And that's certainly a discipline that you've spent most of your career studying and writing about. So I want to introduce to my audience Virginia Sumney, who is a professor, writer, and historian. She teaches right here at Salem College in downtown Winston-Salem. Virginia, how are you today? Thank you for locking in.
I'm great. Thank you so much for having me.
Yeah, I've got so I've got so many questions prepared here. You're so intelligent. So I really went the extra mile to prepare for today's conversation because I wanted my audience to get just the full scope of some of the great work you've done. Let's just start off because you've written a book and it's gotten a little bit of attention over the years. You wrote about a lady named Judge Elrita Melton Alexander, who I actually knew nothing about. And I was really taken aback with our conversation and some of the research that you did on Judge Alexander. Let's start there. I mean, what made you write the book and how did you discover Judge Alexander?
Yeah, well, thank you for asking about her. She has been a big part of my life since, gosh, probably 2011 now. But I was in my master's program at the University of Montana, and I was taking a class called Writing Women's Lives with my mentor, Dr. Anya Jabbour. And I had lived in Montana for several years at that point. I'm born and bred in Western North Carolina, but I, wanted to explore, wanted to travel, and found myself in Montana for the better part of a decade. And I was learning things about North Carolina history that I hadn't learned growing up in North Carolina. And so one of those things was just about fascinating events, but fascinating women. And so I knew there were lots of stories out there to be told. And so I believe it was the North Carolina History Museum's website, and there was a timeline. And on there I saw 1968, Elrita Alexander becomes the first Black woman to become an elected district court judge. And so I just started researching her, and it kind of snowballed from there into what became the book. But found out she was the first Black woman to graduate from Columbia Law in 1945, first to practice law in North Carolina, first to be an elected judge in the country. And she was doing all of this during the civil rights movement in Greensboro. And so it adds a layer of complexity to Greensboro's civil rights story, which is known primarily for the A&T4. But it adds, there was so much else going on in Greensboro, civil rights wise, and really just this phenomenal woman who was, breaking down barriers and even, changing the way juries are selected in the state of North Carolina, changing the way judicial elections are held. And so I ended up doing my whole master's thesis on her. And fortunately, she has an archival collection that is housed at UNC Greensboro. And so I applied to the PhD program at UNCG and fortunately got in. And, it just kind of kept going from there.
For someone, including myself and, even folks in my audience that may not be as aware of Judge Alexander, what makes her legacy and some of what she accomplished, what makes it relevant to today's time and some of what we're experiencing?
Well, I think she was doing all of these things during turbulent times, definitely. She was doing them in the face of For what many would consider almost insurmountable personal issues, she had was in an abusive marriage, and so she was dealing with a very destructive marriage. But just any time, especially, and I don't want to sound too jargony, but this intersection of race and class, any time when you're pioneering or spearheading something, there's a little bit of, oh my goodness. So when, she was admitted to Columbia Law, the dean of Columbia Law said, you were the first woman of your race that we have admitted to this institution, and how you do depends on whether or not we will admit others.
A lot of
And
weight,
so,
a lot of pressure.
lot of pressure. And so I think it's certainly relevant today because there are things that she barriers that she did not end up being able to surmount later in her career. But just, I mean, as a woman, I was able to relate with having to deal with, multiple aspects of your life and what makes up you, and having to compartmentalize certain aspects of your life professionally, particularly professionally and personally. But I think, as far as it's relevant today, yeah, I mean, this is definitely a time when she would be, the DEI candidate or something like that. And so, but really, when she was, the most qualified person for the job.
It's striking because I think within the Black community, that pressure is still very much felt. To be the only one, the first one to go to college, or the first one to be accepted into whatever institution you get accepted in, or the first one to obtain a certain professional title or credential. I mean, you still see that same pressure on a lot of Black individuals and families, even today's time. That's remarkable. When you think about how long ago she lived, for someone, and again, I was very unaware of the process that occurs when you go to write a biography or, write about someone's life the way you did. Talk to my audience a little bit about that process. What does it feel like to sort of write the book and the research that's involved and the discovery that you're going through as you're writing the book?
Well, the research is my favorite part. That's why I became a historian. I love to research. I love to be a researcher. I love spending time in archives. Writing about her was probably easier than I would have had writing about other people because she left behind about 200 pages of oral histories. And so I was fortunate enough that her narrative was largely able to drive the book. There's so much of, so much of, what is in there comes directly from her. And of course, having to corroborate all that. But I would say, like writing about any human being, there was contradictions and things where I'm like, oh my God, well, why did she do that? And so just anytime when you're writing about a person, you're going to be writing about somebody that might be amazing and you might love and you might admire them, but they're also flawed, complex people. And I think you want, in writing a biography, you don't want it to be a hagiography. You want it to be an honest depiction of somebody. And so, yeah, being able to kind of humanize those complexities about her was one of the more challenging aspects.
Outside the racial aspect, just looking at the more the gender dimension of Judge Alexander being a woman, and women even in today's time are still working to shatter the glass ceiling that former Secretary of State Hillary Clinton talked about. We see in so many developed countries around the world where they've already elected their first woman president. Here in the United States, we still struggle to be able to check that box. thinking about Judge Alexander and the story that you, her story, and what you wrote about and what you learned, what are some strategies that maybe she was using in a male-dominated society in her time that would be applicable or could be leveraged in today's time?
Like I said, she was a master at compartmentalization, being able to set aside what was going on in her personal life, with her husband. She also had a son who suffered from paranoid schizophrenia. And so being able to focus on the task at hand, whether it was, a campaign, a contentious court case, and then as a judge, these innovative sentencing methods that she used. She was really brilliant at being able to put her personal life aside when it needed to go to the side, which I think is something that can be good and be bad, but something that is extremely difficult to do. Also, just she was so secure in herself. She knew who she was, and she knew her talents, and she knew her intellect, and she was not going to allow the circumstances, the racial circumstances of the day, really dictate how she treated other people from the bench, or from a perspective of defending them in court. One of my favorite stories is where, she would be trying a case as a defense attorney. And she would stay in the segregated section of the courtroom, and the judge would be like, "No, Attorney Alexander, you need to come to the bench." And she said, "I'm just following the letter of the law here. I am going to stay with my people in this segregated section, so you need to listen up because I am, I'm going to try my case from here as, as per the law." So she was really secure enough in her ability to point out the hypocrisies of segregation, and command that kind of attention. So I think it was, yeah, her compartmentalization, her strong sense of self. Yeah, it would be very to do some of the things that she did. Like, wow, that took a lot of guts.
And so I was about to say, it sounds like that she was quite gutsy. And to my audience, if you're just now joining the show, my name is Algernon Cash. You are Locked In. And the other voice that you hear with me today is Virginia Summey. She is a professor, a writer, historian. And we're talking about the biography of Judge L. L. Oh, I'm messing up there, Virginia. Elrita, Judge Elrita Melton Alexander, and just the incredible life that she lived. One more question about your book, and I want you to make sure you plug your book as well. What is the name of the book? Where can we find it, and all that
Right
great
here.
stuff?
It is called The Life of Elrita Melton Alexander, Activism Within the Courts. It was published by the University of Georgia Press. So you can find it wherever books are sold, really. I know that there are copies at Bookmarks in downtown Winston. I know there are copies at South Main Books in Salisbury, or you can buy it online through the University of Georgia Press website.
I love that. I love that. That's so great. One more question about Judge Elrita. Here in North Carolina, I mean, obviously, what she was able to accomplish was impressive. But talk a little bit about maybe what followed after. What were the doors that she ended up opening, through her life?
So, as I said, the dean of Columbia Law School said, her performance would depend on, whether or not they would admit other Black women. The second Black woman they admitted to Columbia Law was Constance Baker Motley, who became the first Black woman to have a federal judicial post, and who has been more researched and more written about than Judge Alexander. And she became much more famous on a national level, particularly with her work in desegregation of schools in the South. But here in North Carolina, you have at the same time that she was running for Chief Justice of the Supreme Court, Susie Sharp was running. But you have so you have a time when there are other women, pioneering women. But it was a couple decades later when you have Patricia Timmons Gudson, who was the first Black woman on the North Carolina Supreme Court. And then you have since then you've had, I believe it's now three Black women on the North Carolina Supreme Court. But you do see, I mean, she was definitely able to, because of her success, have other, women and particularly, women of color go into the legal profession.
I think that's impressive. And I mean, I think you do a good job of highlighting, like, throughout history, you've had a lot of women that have fought for justice. But it appears, Virginia, that a lot of those narratives have been sort of sidelined when you look at, the mainstream conversation of today. I mean, again, I consider myself to be a fairly intelligent person and have never heard about any of the people that you're talking about and have written about. It's not necessarily taught in, traditional education. So, what patterns have you noticed that have sort of downplayed or sidelined women's contributions throughout history?
Well, I think particularly unless you are a historian, unless you're getting, a bachelor's degree or above in history, there's so much that you have to teach, particularly in a K through 12 curriculum, and you have to hit certain high points. And so there's, simply not enough time to get to every single fascinating story that's out there. And I think that's one of the reasons why I, in addition to teaching, work in the public history realm. And that's partially to be able to bring these stories to a wider audience, whether it's through, researching for a local organization or museum. But there just hasn't been, and as far as she's concerned, Elrita is concerned, I'm not sure why there hadn't been a whole lot about her. As I mentioned, Justice Patricia Timmons Goodson, who was the first Black woman on the North Carolina Supreme Court, had written an article about her in the Elon Law Review. But when I was really getting started on my research, that was about it that was written about her. And so I would, first of all, I would encourage other historians to, you don't have to go very far to find, really amazing stories about really amazing people. I was in Montana writing about her, but I just, we joke in my family that she ended up bringing me back home. And so, I don't have all the answers as to why she's been, overlooked, except, obvious issues of, racism and sexism that are, pervasive everywhere. But yeah, I would say that, the stories like hers are unique, but there's still lots of them out there.
Well, how about this? Help us understand, since we're learning so much history today, and I love history. That's why I think I'm so drawn to you and can have these long conversations with you. Because even the day we had coffee, I think we were together a couple hours, and I could have did another couple hours just because I felt like I was learning so much. And I'm someone, I spend a lot of time, watching historical documentaries and reading books, and I'm just fascinated by history. And I'm fascinated by the patterns that you can see in history, because those patterns typically they reveal themselves again. History does repeat itself. So for someone like me and many others that don't understand how historical curriculum comes together, help walk us through that a little bit. How does the curriculum within the education system around history come together? How do we select or choose what we're going to talk about and focus our attention on, and what we're going to some degree ignore?
And that's a question for somebody more experienced in curriculum development than I am. I've never worked in K through 12 schools. I just, am a product of, North Carolina public schools, in a good way. But yeah, I mean, right now, I mean, what I know as somebody who teaches on a collegiate level, there is lots of questions about, what are we going to be able to teach? What are we going to be allowed to teach? And, and very scary questions that we're kind of faced with at this moment. And so I would say, yeah, much of it, much of it is political. One of those things that I learned about when I was living in Montana was something like, the 1898 coup d'etat in Wilmington. That wasn't taught in North Carolina public schools until very, very recently. And certainly not when I was coming through in the 80s and 90s. And so, yeah, there is a lot of focus on, I would call it feel-good history. And history, if I think this has kind of become a popular quote now, but history, isn't always is it actually very rarely a feel-good subject if you're doing it correctly. And so, yeah, so I think there are lots of political reasons, lots of social reasons why we don't always talk about, a lot of history, which is often, very messy.
With your role at Salem College here in Winston-Salem, you're a professor there. There's a lot of talk coming out of Washington about DEI. You sort of alluded to it a moment ago in some of your comments. Some of the policies that we're watching over the last 30 days come out of the new administration related to DEI, and we're supposed to be hearing more this week about the Department of Education. I think there's a number of people that are scheduled to be fired, or maybe they plan on resigning. I don't know what phrase or term they want to use nowadays, but there's obviously an overhaul happening with education in our country. How is that influencing and impacting what you do in Winston-Salem at Salem College?
First of all, I mean, I'm not speaking for Salem in any way. I'm
Of
actually
course.
just even an adjunct there. They needed a historian, and I was happy to fulfill the role. And so I'm, incredibly indebted to them to for keeping me in the classroom, which I have very much enjoyed, particularly at Salem. But I would say, for me personally, it reaffirms my commitment to being a women's historian, to being a historian of people of color, and to, telling the stories that, might not get told otherwise because it's, brings up uncomfortable truths. So for me, and that's just my personality, my tendency is to double down. And be like, well, I'm just going to teach women's history harder. But yeah, I think it definitely for me has, reaffirmed my commitment to telling, to telling the stories about women and people of color in this country, because it is really, particularly, I'm teaching African American history at Salem this semester, and it's such an important class. And it's the foundation of American history. It's not, an ancillary part of American history. It is American history. And yeah, so yeah, I'm just more determined to keep teaching those subjects.
Well, my audience knows I've often stated that I think the African American community, or the Black community, however you want to say it, we are by far one of the most patriotic members of America, for sure. And we've put a lot of blood, sweat, and tears into building this country, and we should recognize that. We should recognize the contributions that we made, and that this is our country, very much so. Even if people, others may not seem to believe that, it's very important that we believe it. You talk about African American history, and I can tell you're someone that's passionate about people of color, and obviously the historical context. You wrote an op-ed on the famed Confederate monument. You called for its removal due to its reinforcement of systemic racism. What kind of pushback or even support did you receive? And how does this reflect the broader debate on just our historical memory?
I got I would say it was I got a lot of praise, and I joke that I really don't talk to anybody I went to high school with either, except for a couple people. So I was actually really proud of that piece. And it was even, brought up in, the Salisbury City Council. I went to high school outside of Salisbury in East Rowan. And I think it was reflective because the people who were so angry about what I wrote. Well, of course, there was the, well, you can't remove history. I'm like, nobody's removing history. A statue is not history. A statue is, a very small piece that, chooses to commemorate a certain aspect. But, nobody's really teaching history via statues. But particularly, one of the reasons why I was so, having went to high school out there, and then I stayed in Salisbury and went to Catawba College. It goes back to some of the things that I learned, as a graduate student, that, Granite Quarry, North Carolina, was the home of the Grand Master of the Ku Klux Klan in the 1960s. And that a lot of people who I grew up within that area didn't know that, but even if that's not emphasized, there was still an attitude, a systemic issue that an assistant a systemic attitude in that area. And so I was, really, honored that I got to write that piece, because it is, and I think I said this, it's a signal that Salisbury is not going to, or any city that takes down their Confederate monuments, that we're not going to honor the worst parts of our past, but go forward, as an inclusive community. And it's hard to have an inclusive community when, the big prominent statue literally in the intersection, of a major thoroughfare through town, honors, honors as section of the country that split off to preserve the institution of slavery. So, yeah, so I was, like, no, this time.
We had the same debate here in Winston-Salem, and I can recall my good friend who's the former mayor of Lexington, Newell Clark. They had a similar debate down in Lexington, and I think these debates continue, Virginia, right? All around the South and the country. How do we handle how do we handle the statues then, in a way that we still promote honest historical education? I mean, what's your opinion on that?
Well, I think we honor, accurate historic education. I mean, and it does go back to issues like, curriculums, and things like that. Of course, there's been lists going around about, what historians or, teachers can and can't say anymore. And we're definitely sliding into an area where it's going to be very difficult to teach accurate. Well, it's going to be very difficult for some to receive accurate historical information if you can't use the word diversity in your classroom or on your syllabus. It's gonna, that makes it kind of it's gonna make it tough for a lot of people. But I mean, as far as the continued debates go, I think, just the debate in and of itself, and it being so in the news, was really able to highlight the fact that, a statue, sometimes is not, sometimes, like I said, honors the worst part of our past. And it's important to recognize those.
Yeah, it may be honest, but and we're remembering history honestly, but what are we really shining a light on is what you're
Exactly.
trying to say, and I totally understand that.
Exactly.
Just a couple more questions for you, then I'm gonna let you go. I'm telling you, I could do this. We could do this all day. Now, I don't know about my audience because maybe everybody doesn't have the appreciation of history that I do, but for Women's History Month, I just think this is such a great conversation. You're a historian, and you sound like someone who really values historical accuracy and context and so forth. We seem to be in this age of misinformation and disinformation. And to some degree, I would start to argue that we are even rewriting history to some degree. We all cannot any longer agree on what the historical facts were. And that's whether you're talking about January 6th, and we see recently that now we seem to misremember whether Russia invaded Ukraine. And I could go on and on about this, okay? I mean, what is that? How do you feel as a historian when you see this sort of active rewriting of history in real time?
Frustrated. It's like, oh my gosh, or, it's a little stunning, actually. But it, it's this isn't the first time it's happened. One of the reasons why we have so many Confederate monuments was because, when in the post-Civil War era, when you had the creation of the United Daughters of the Confederacy, they were completely dedicated and extraordinarily successful in rewriting the causes behind the Civil War. And so, so this isn't a new game here necessarily. Of course, it's happening so much faster with, social media and technology. And so the misinformation is spreading faster. I know in my classroom, I've really doubled down on sourcing exercises with my students. They're probably going to get a little tired of them, but saying, who wrote this? When did they write it? Who was their audience? What were they trying to achieve? And just and that's something I have seen for a long time is the inability to critically analyze the information that you're consuming. And whether it's, a gossip column or whether it's, a political post on Facebook, just the ability to really critically analyze information is definitely at a low, I would say.
It is. It's like we can't all, you used to be able to tell like a clear line between opinion and fact. And you never expected for everyone to have the same opinion. I mean, that's just not going to happen. But at one point in time, I remember we could at least agree on the facts and agree on what the history was. And now I find Virginia, we can't even agree on that. And that to me is not only, you said frustrating, but it's also a bit scary. I mean, it really is. And I made the mistake over the weekend. I had to journal about this yesterday, Virginia. I made the mistake of getting into a Facebook spat with someone.
We've all been there.
I am political, Virginia, and I made a political post about, the president Zelensky's visit to the Oval Office this past Friday. I thought it was just completely embarrassing for our country and asinine behavior. And I posted about it, and of course, it drew in a lot of attention and a lot of energy on both sides. I could literally go through the comments, and it was like a half and half. I think the comment section of my post is reflective of where the country is right now. And if you were to go through and read, and I got frustrated because some of the things that were being said just were not factual. And I made the wrong decision to wade into the Facebook waters, and three or four hours later, after trying to convince someone that I'm actually correct, finally I disengaged, and I had to even journal about the it was so heavy within my spirit, I had to journal about the experience yesterday, and it's just really scary where we are as a country, a nation. and as a body of people. My last question for you, I know you're working on something new. You told me about the project that you're working on in Wilmington. Go ahead and give us a little teaser on what we can expect from you next.
Well, I haven't gotten very far on it. And I had started on this in 2019, and then COVID, and then I had a baby during COVID. And so he's now 4, so I'm kind of being able to get back in the archives again. But I think one of even my students at Salem who are 18, 19, 20 years old don't know a whole lot about the events that happened in Wilmington in November of 1898. And so much of the white supremacist campaign of the 1890s in North Carolina was based on this predication of, the protection of white womanhood, that we have to protect, white women from, this black male rapist. And even there were these horrible cartoons in the news and Raleigh News and Observer that depicted, black men as a vampire that were kind of scooping up white women. But we have very few white women's voices from that period. We have Rebecca Latimer Fountain, who was actually the first, very, very briefly for a day, the first female United States senator from Georgia. But we don't, and who was also a white supremacist from Georgia, but we don't have very many voices of these white women. And so part of me is exploring where one, were white women as concerned about their own protection as these white men? And to what extent was this, rhetoric, I mean, obviously it was a political tool to get people to vote for, the white supremacist ticket. To what extent have were white women complicit in this, essentially? And so it's a huge departure from what I was writing about somebody who is, like Judge Alexander, who was, breaking barriers and who is such an admirable woman, two women who I'm, probably not going to really enjoy that much. But I think it's definitely another piece of this story of Wilmington, the only successful coup d'etat in American history, that we are still learning, more and more about, and kind of expanding, the players involved.
Sounds fascinating. That's a great teaser. We're going to encourage
We'll
you.
see.
The entire locked in audience is encouraging you, Virginia, to go ahead and get that book across the finish line so that we can read your thoughts and share some of your insight and commentary. Some would argue that we might be in the second coup d'etat of the United States right now. I don't know. We'll have to keep watching here closely, day by day, day by day. But thank you so much, Virginia, for joining me. I am so thrilled that we had a chance to meet at our favorite coffee shop, which
Yes, it
undisclosed location here in Winston-Salem. You will never know where to find us.
Oh, yeah.
I look forward to continuing to run into you and having more conversation. And now you are on the list of contributors for the Locked In show. So we will be reaching back out to you and arranging for you to come back and visit once again. To my audience, it is Women's History Month. And so if you are looking for a great read in the month of March, go check out The Life of Judge Elrita Melton Alexander, written by Virginia Summey. It's available wherever you like to find your favorite books. You can find that book there. And of course, you can find it on Amazon. As always, thank you for locking in with me. Make sure you stay tuned to WTOB because every Sunday morning, that's where you can lock in with me. But if you happen to miss me there, hopefully you're subscribed to the podcast. You can find that on Apple, Spotify, Pandora, wherever you like to get your favorite podcast. You can always lock in there. And until next time, y'all stay locked in.
The executive producer of the Locked In podcast is Algernon Cash for WGC. The associate producer is Tim Beeman for Such and Such Media. This podcast is copyrighted and cannot be reproduced without express written consent of WGC.